This is the Tom Likas Show.
I'm not Barack Obama.
Thank you. I'm glad to hear that.
And now, from the New Normal Studios in
Yes.
Thank you for tuning into the Tom Likas Show. This is what you hear is live Monday through Friday, 3 p.m. Pacific time, 6 p.m. Eastern time. 24-7 is Tom.show. You can hear us on our free app. Get it at the App Store. Get it at Google Play. Or get it at TomEverywhere.com. That's TomEverywhere.com. Thank you for tuning in. Thanks for being part of the program. A bonus hour of the Tom Likas Show. We're joined in studio by Quibble Defense Attorney Adam Sachs. Adam! What's going on?
Great to be here, Tom.
What's happening?
Great show today, Tom. Really great. It was great hearing Paul Elam.
Yes.
And it's interesting hearing you talking about the connection with religion and terrorism. And since we're talking about criminal law, I think there's a couple of crossovers we need to know about some of these things, you know. One of the first platitudes that we hear right away is gun control. And I know that you're a pro-gun guy, generally speaking, Tom.
I am.
You know, this is something that dates back to the Constitution, the Second Amendment. And I truly believe that the more left parties like the Democrats and Clinton, you know, and Barack Obama really sincerely believe that the solution to these problems with school shootings and all these things is gun control. And I think it's been well shown that that's really not going to work. If you look at the reality, it's really like the cat is quite out of the bag. The amount of firearms that are already circulating in the United States are far greater than the population. I think we could take all the guns that exist and put two or three of them in the hands of every man, woman, and child in the whole country and still have quite a few left. So I don't see how come they always have to harp on gun control. And, you know, the reality of what's happening in Europe, I think, is a much greater indication overall of where we're going and what's happening in this world. You know, the biggest threat that the world truly faces is failed states. That might sound strange, but it's actually true. What ends up happening in all over the world is there are countries that collapse, that fall apart. That's a failed state. So it's a country that doesn't have a stable government, doesn't do the regular things of, you know, distributing water and electricity and having a police force and dealing with borders and everything else that a state accomplishes. And one of the greatest bad legacies of Barack Obama is that he has allowed a number of failed states to come into existence in terms of the loss of the states that had existed. And what's always awful when you look at a country like, let's say, Libya, that for a very long time had a very repressive and psychotic man, the dictator, Muammar Gaddafi, leading the country. But the truth of the matter is that when you have a country like Libya, and you have a strong man or whatever he is holding things together, that can actually be a stabilizing force. And very often countries have to look at it that way. And like in terms of the United States, they say, look, you know, we're better off with a devil we know than the devil we don't know, which means that if we get rid of Gaddafi, then we could end up with something even worse. And what's actually happened is that you have Gaddafi being overthrown and the country rapidly disintegrating into regions and civil war, and the whole nation itself stopping to exist, and Libya became a failed state. And what failed states tend to do is they tend to lead to other problems, such as terrorism and these regional groups and so forth. Syria is another country that had a dictator for a very long time. It was originally the father, Assad, and later became the son, Assad. But that's a country that Obama also allowed to fall apart. And that country disintegrated, and that's where we see, combined with the disintegration of Iraq, the rise of ISIS. And that's, again, a terrorist organization that's taking parts of these failed countries and taking advantage of the vacuum created by the lack of a government. And the real informative situation that needs to be looked at for the world, and especially for the United States, is not the fact that the United States takes 75,000 Muslim immigrants a year or whatever, but what's happening in Europe. In Europe, you have nation states that are relatively small compared to the United States. If you look at England or Germany, these countries are countries that are the size of Florida or the size of New York, that are whole countries. But you talk about a nation like Germany, which is taking in 1.5 million Muslims in the past year or two, and is projecting that they're going to take in many millions more. And this is also true for France, very large populations of immigrants and Muslim immigrants, and England and some of the other countries in Europe. If you look what's happening, and particularly Germany is a great example. Another really good example is Sweden, which is a relatively small population, about 8 million people, and it's taken in more than a million Muslim immigrants and is going to plan to take millions more, is that this ends up causing a lot of social change. Now, I am an atheist, and I think that religions are, you know, screwy, each in their own ways. I'm not a big proponent of the New Testament, the Old Testament, or the Quran, but there is a big difference between religions. And the truth of the matter is that if you look at Christianity in particular, it's already gone through a lot of its own crises and reformations, and the religion Islam has not done that. And it may not be able to do that ever because of some of the fundamental principles of Islam, which are different. It has a unique claim, which is that it is the final revealed word of God. And it also talks about the fact that it is not meant to be questioned and is not meant to be discussed in any way. When you look at the religious writing itself, there's the main book, which is the Quran, but then there are the hadiths and the surahs, which are the interpretations, which are very old. And these are analyses of what the writing means, and it is not meant to be discussed. When you look at the way Jews study the Torah, which is the Old Testament, it's usually in a pair of two boys, and they read different passages from the Torah, and the two of them argue about it. And what does that mean, and what did God mean? And in fact, the word Israel itself, that name, which is obviously the name of the modern Jewish country, is the person who wrestled with God, which meant that he disagreed and he argued with God, and it was an angel of God, and what he had done is that he wrestled with the angel and he won. And if you look at Islam by its very name, the word Islam means to submit, which means that you are supposed to do what you are instructed, and you're supposed to submit to the will of God, and you're not supposed to question. Now, what I saw with my own eyes, and this is something that people are not aware of, in one of the greatest of all the Muslim countries, as an example, Saudi Arabia, which has a pretty strict interpretation of Islam, and this is what the world would look like if Islam, you know, ruled the world. This is the basic prototype of a truly theocratic Islamic state, a relatively successful nation, relatively rich nation. But, I mean, men and women are very, very, very strictly segregated. And so what that means, generally speaking, is that aside from your own mother and your sisters, who you have very limited contact with anyway, you do not, as a young man, come into contact with women. From a very, very early age, the sexes are separated in school, socializing. When you're a boy and you're playing in the playground, girls are not allowed out to play. You're not going to run into any girls whatsoever. And you're also going to get married, generally speaking, at a much older date, because you're supposed to generally have the ability to be independent. So that means you have to kind of grow up, finish school, have money, build a house, and then maybe when you're in your late 20s or early 30s will be your opportunity to potentially get married. And so I have to say that considering the expression you see in terms of sexuality, where they have, you know, homosexuality being extremely forbidden, and they're hanging homosexuals from construction cranes and so forth. The truth is, I saw so much homosexuality going on. You could just see all of it in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere. It's astounding. It's everywhere, because young men literally don't have a choice. It's not that they're gay necessarily in any greater quantity than anyone else, but they literally don't have an option until they're almost 30. And it's like being in prison, essentially. It's like, if there's nothing else, then you have to just, I guess, be with other guys. And that's something that goes on very overtly and covertly as well. And the religion is really sick in that way. You know, there's a question of which created which. And, you know, when you look at history, there have probably always been gay people throughout history. I mean, that's something that just is part of human nature. And it is possible that it's not the Catholic Church that ends up having gay priests that molest children. It's probably the reason that the Catholic Church exists in the first place. It's very possible that throughout history, if you were gay, there was no place for you. And so what you could do is you could become a priest and be in the church. And instead of being killed or being tortured, being arrested and hassled in the world, you would be respected, and you'd be able to have a way of channeling your sexuality in secret, which would be being a priest and being with the other priests, or getting with children in the parish or whatever. And that, you know, originally the whole crisis of pedophilia in the church was supposed to be, you know, just in Boston. And then it was supposed to be just America, because we're so sick and we're such perverts. And ultimately it was acknowledged, you know, by the church that this was a worldwide, system-wide problem. And this is something that that they're coming to grips with. And I think that the church is in steep and massive decline and probably will never recover from this. That is the pedophile priest scandal and so forth. But if you look at what's happening today, and I respect you a lot, Tom, and I know that you're saying these things like, you know, look at the McVeighs of the world and the different kinds of terrorists that we've had. The real truth is that we have something now that is very, very cancerous. It exists in a big way in the Western world, particularly, as I mentioned, in Europe. And it's something that the United States is a little late, but it's coming here too in a very big way. And the societies are going to have to deal with it. Now, something very historical is happening in the next couple of days, in about a week and a half, is that, you know, the European countries came together. Well, they had in the past, you know, with NATO and so forth, but they came together some years ago and formed a political union. And this was called the European Union. And this was meant to be, by some accounts, the United States of Europe. Now, there were different aspects of this union, and part of the union originally was as a trading bloc, which meant that the countries would all trade with each other without taxes, without any kind of tariffs. And, you know, originally in the United States, there were tariffs sometimes considered between goods from New York and goods from New Jersey and so forth. And one of the great things of the political union of the United States was making the United States one single trading zone, which it is, of course. And so the Europeans did that. They also did what they call a monetary union, and that's where you hear of the new currency, which is called the euro, which the European countries actually did not all accept, but most of them did take. And that's how you have, you know, the Deutschmark is gone. You have the euro in Germany and France, and you don't have the franc in France anymore. But some countries, such as England, joined the European Union, but still continue to use their own currency from their own central bank. Giving up your currency is a big loss of national control over your economy, obviously, and some countries were reluctant to do that, England being one of them. And you've seen some of the crises where, for example, Greece has had this ongoing economic crisis, and also Ireland and Portugal and Spain and some of the other European countries, particularly the southern ones, are having financial problems because of their connection to this monetary union. And then one of the other aspects was the freedom of movement of people. So this means that when you have richer and poorer countries in the European Union, for example, if you have a poorer country like Poland or Romania, people in those countries may be very tempted to go to a richer country like Germany or England and take their social services and so forth, because there's a lot of free stuff being given in terms of housing and welfare. And this is something that was discussed in the United States. I remember when I was younger, people were coming from southern states and also Puerto Rico to New York, because New York had more social welfare. And so there were people that were from, you know, poor parts of Mississippi or whatever, let's say, that were trying to move to eastern states to be able to get, you know, northern states, of course, to be able to get more benefits. Now, what's happening, as I mentioned, in about 10 days, is that England is voting something very historic to consider leaving the European Union. They call this the Brexit, which is the British exit from the European Union. And this is something that is very controversial. There are people that want to stay in the European Union. They're called Remainers. And they go across both political sides, the right and the left of English politics. And it seems like most of the establishment wants people to stay. But then there's a very large number of people that want to exit the European Union, and would be that England would be independent again and not have this European Union government over them. Essentially, what they've done is they've turned Brussels, which is in Belgium, essentially the Washington, D.C. capital of Europe, and they've developed this entire government with a Supreme Court and with a parliament, and they're going to raise even an army. And their law actually governs all of Europe. And so, in other words, if England passes a law, that law can be overruled by the central government in the same way that the rules of a single state like New York or New Jersey can be overruled by the United States' federal government. And this is something that is very, very heavy stuff for England, for example, to have essentially given up their sovereignty in a lot of ways. And there are a lot of people who feel that this is going to be more and more fascistic, because the leaders of the European Union are extremely privileged and extremely dictators, essentially, at some point. They're becoming more and more centralized and powerful and unelected. And this is something that is starting to make people think that this is like the new Soviet Union, where you have this kind of central authority dictating to the rest of the countries. Now, the crisis of the migration is very significant. And again, going back to what I said about failed states, people have to have seen this on TV. You have unbelievably large numbers of people taking a terribly risky trip, where they get into these little boats and they kind of come across from Syria through Turkey and Lebanon and try to get to Greece. Because from there, once they make land, they're in the European Union, and then they're trying to go north, and there's some trips that they take through some of the states in Hungary and so forth in order to get to the richer countries, which are in the north of the continent, particularly England and Germany and Sweden. And these are people that are coming to Sweden and elsewhere and are not your average refugees. There have already been many, many incidents, and these are sort of like a culture clash. Just something that the late, great Harvard professor Samuel Huntington talked about in The Clash of Civilizations, was that the cultures would clash between the East and the West. And if you see Islamic men, which is what most of the migrants are, they're emphasizing women and children, but apparently that's less than 3%. It's young men who are coming. Essentially, instead of staying in Syria and fighting the civil war, they're getting the hell out to look for a better life for themselves. And they come to Europe and they see women in Sweden walking around in miniskirts, and they literally are like grabbing them on the streets. And so there's been perceived to be a real lack of safety and increased number of assaults and rapes and all this other kind of stuff, and a whole, you know, different lawlessness. And if England really does vote to leave the European Union, it's very likely that the European Union may collapse. Because England is one of the, you know, more significant economies in Europe, and it is a big shock. It's a very stunning thing. We're living in absolutely historic times. And interestingly, the president, Barack Obama, our president, of course, went to England, and he actually threatened the English. He actually said on their television that they better not leave Europe. Because if they did, the United States would punish them by putting them at the end of the line in terms of any kind of trade deals with the United States. And this is unbelievable, because, you know, the United States and England have been historically friendly nations going back, you know, hundreds of years of the common history. You know, we obviously had wars in the origin of the country, in the Revolutionary War and the War of 1812. But after that, the relationship between the two countries has always been extremely unique and special in the world. And, you know, Barack Obama is actually someone that has some serious hatred for the old world, certainly hatred for England. There's sort of this story that when he joined as president in his first few days in office, he took a bust, which had been given by the British government to the United States, of Winston Churchill, which had been in the Oval Office, and had it returned to the embassy of England. It's a big insult to return a gift. And apparently this was also showing his hatred of Churchill, who's a great hero to the English for saving them from the Nazis. But at the same time, he was also the colonial secretary at one time. And Barack Obama's father is a very known revolutionary and hater of colonialism and of England's colonial past, particularly in Kenya. And this is something that Obama apparently takes very personally. And so he actually went and told the English, you know, you're going to be real sorry if you try to, you know, do this thing and assert your sovereignty and pull out of the European Union. And this is something that all ties together in terms of worldview and perspective. Now, I lived for many years in Israel, and in Israel there are tons of Muslims. And I have gotten to know many of them. I think a lot of them are very decent people, and I don't, you know, have any particular issue. I really believe, as crazy as religion is, and I say that in all fairness to all religions, I'm known to be Jewish, and I don't think that my religion is any more brilliant than any other religion, which I think they're all a bunch of nonsense. But when you talk about the culture, generally speaking, Islam is very, very retrograde. It is. It's a fact. It is very, very tough on the rights of women, for example. Unbelievable. And people know this. You see women being veiled and forced to marry their cousins and given female genital mutilation and lists and lists of things. Women are generally prevented from getting educations and having all kinds of rights that we take for granted in the West. And I think that women in the West should kiss the ground. They don't even realize how good they have it here. And when you look at the other aspects of Islam, certainly being gay, for example, I mean, that's just absolutely retrograde in terms of gays being just killed, being discriminated against, generally speaking. The president of Iran came to the U.S., and he said that Iran doesn't have any gays, I mean, because it's so bad and it's so sinful. And that's really a great denial of reality. I think what you see with this Orlando shooting is that that guy, the shooter, was probably gay. I mean, seriously, he was going to that club many times. He had gone to other gay clubs. He was a member of a gay dating site, and he apparently was conflicted. But the problem is, in the religions that deny reality, and certainly Islam, which is the most, as I said, retrograde of all the religions, you know, there's no place for him to kind of work things out. And so when he strikes out, he, you know, killed gay people in a gay bar in a way that his religion actually believes is correct. And what's unbelievable is the headline in the Turkish, for example, an Islamic country, Turkey's main newspaper, which is controlled by the government, published about this story in Orlando. It's the headline is 50 sick perverts killed in gay bar. So, you know, this is their consideration, and there are imams, including one that had spoken at the local mosque in Orlando a few weeks ago with his YouTube, saying that the only cure for homosexuals and the only thing you can do with homosexuals is kill them, is wipe them out, because they're sick and they're horrific and all that. And so, you know, as much as we have all these different aspects in our culture, and we have trying to say, you know, fair enough, religion is just twisted all around, I think that modern Christians and modern Jews tend to be much more reasonable and tolerant. I've heard the Pope say that, gays are sinners and they should abstain or they should pray for salvation, which is bullshit. But I don't hear him calling for them to be killed, and I don't hear Jews saying that either. And what I do hear in Islam being screamed from the rooftops is that they should be killed. And so the problem with Islam today, unfortunately, and it's not going to reform itself, is that it is really the mother load of bad ideas. And if people are coming from Syria as migrants and they're coming to the United States and they represent a small population, you know, that's fine. They can do what they want. Maybe their grandchildren will assimilate or whatever. But, you know, there was another shooting today in Walmart in Texas. And what people don't even know, when they didn't even mention in the news, is that that was a Somali Muslim who did that. And now, it doesn't mean that every single thing is religiously motivated. But if you look at these violent acts, they're being done by Muslims, and we are pretending that it's not true. The shooting at Fort Hood, which was on an army base, was done by a Muslim psychiatrist, and he was screaming Allah Akbar. And the official government reporting of that incident is that it was workplace violence. And you see, and this is something they argue on the different networks, Obama and now Hillary are not willing to say that this is something that has to do with Islam. You know, Obama spent many years of his childhood growing up in Indonesia, which is an Islamic nation. He went to a madrasa, which is an Islamic school. This was for 3 or 4 years, I believe. And he was registered in that school as a Muslim student. So I don't know if Obama's a Muslim or not, and I don't really care. I don't think there's any big conspiracy that he is or he isn't. I think he's an atheist, to tell you the truth. But he has some kind of personal belief that he has to be a defender of this religion and that he doesn't want to have it badmouthed in any way. And he wants to somehow introduce it in a positive light. And he went on a tour in the beginning of his presidency, in 2009, where he went to the different Muslim countries and went and apologized for the United States' behavior towards them. And he has distanced the United States from one of its closest friends, which is Israel. And this is something that I believe is very much rooted in his ideology, that Islam is, you know, a great thing, and you know, there should be more of it in the United States and more of it in the Western world. But the real truth is that Islam is deeply antithetical to Western thinking. And if you look at what's happened in England, which has a substantial Islamic population, this is also true in France and now in Germany and Sweden and elsewhere, there are all these no-go zones. That means that there are all sections in Paris, for example, where the police won't even go, where the Muslims are in complete control. In England, the Muslim population, more than 90% of them are married to their first cousins. I mean, I don't know if people understand what that means. They're already having diseases that haven't been seen in years because they're having recessive genes for marrying extremely close relatives. And the Muslims that I knew in Israel were all married to close relatives. I mean, people don't understand that. And the idea of thinking that a woman is a piece of property, and I'm not talking about some little sex game. I'm talking about the real true belief that a woman doesn't have any rights, and that she has to obey her husband in all things, and that, you know, if she is disobedient, that he can cast her out in the street with nothing or whatever. I mean, these are deeply disturbing things. And if you look at, as I mentioned before, female genital mutilation, which is just disgusting. This is the slicing off of the external parts of a woman's vagina, generally done when they're 11 or 12 years old, in order to protect them from sexuality. I mean, it's so twisted. People don't understand how these things come together. And our society now is deeply, deeply confused, because you can see that we as individuals now, instead of looking at this society and saying, why are there mass shootings? Why are there school shootings? Why are we having Islamic attacks in different parts of the country and other kinds of attacks too? Domestic terrorism, I completely see all of that. And it comes down to me as a citizen not being able to have a gun. I mean, that is so ridiculous. So when you look at the basic American rights in terms of taming the frontier and protecting ourselves, I mean, that's ridiculous. And people mix that up. People think that that's going to somehow help themselves. Instead of looking at it and saying, what caused this? They say, oh, if he didn't have his hands on a gun or whatever. And while it's true, you should maybe have tests for people to make sure they're not crazy or whatever. The mere quantity of guns that are already here, when you inconvenience people with guns, you're inconveniencing honest people. You're making it difficult for people that are good citizens, that have never done anything wrong, that want to defend themselves. It is very difficult to get a permit to carry a concealed gun. And, you know, when you look at this incident, and again, I said I lived in Israel, I'm not saying it's a great thing, but when there have been attacks against civilians in Israel, and it's something that unfortunately happens too often, generally speaking, the attack starts, and half the people in the place are Israeli, are carrying weapons, and shoot the person dead. And you have guards, and you have soldiers, and so forth. It's a completely different kind of society. Now, when you look at these people in this club, in walks this gunman to a gun-free zone. They have these schools that are all gun-free zones. And he shoots all these people. I mean, if any of them had had a gun, they could have shot him dead. They could have shot back. We don't have a society like that. We wait for the police to arrive. He was actually actively shooting for more than 3 hours before he got into a confrontation with a SWAT team that eventually shot him dead. And that shows you, I mean, there has to be some level of self-protection in our society. I don't know that I'm so confident that I trust my life implicitly to the police, that if someone's in my backyard or someone's climbing into a window of my home, that I'm going to dial 911 and hide upstairs and hope for the best. I think it would be prudent to have my own defense and my own ability to come downstairs and shoot the guy. And I have seen too many cases, and this relates to, today being criminal law, I have seen a lot of cases of people charged with firearms violations. And as I said, it is very complicated to get a weapon in most states. Some states are stricter or not, you know, than others. But when you look at some of the places where there's unbelievable gun violence, a good example is Chicago, which is actually Obama's hometown. Chicago has so many murders. It's just gun murders. It's unbelievable. There have been rashes of these, particularly in the past 2 or 3 years. And for a regular citizen, it's almost impossible to have the right to carry a gun. It's very, very difficult. It's mostly ex-police officers that can carry guns. And if I live in Chicago, I'm in danger and I call the police, I'm not going to get a policeman at my house for 25 to 35 minutes. That's the average response time. And meanwhile, I don't have a gun of my own. That's just absolutely insane. And people have to recognize that we are in, like I said, revolutionary times. And there is going to be a big difference. Now, I'm very sensitive about what's happening in England. And I do think that it's probably a very good idea for the British to leave the European Union, for the Brexit to pass. And I think it will lead to the collapse of the European Union, which I think is a good thing. And these changes are paralleled in the United States in our own way, which is obviously the United States is not voting to split up. But on the other hand, we have a very, very stark choice now, which is not just the choice between a woman president or this crazy real estate developer president, but very much a question, I think, deeper. And I do dislike Hillary Clinton very, very much. I can't disacknowledge that. But on the other hand, Hillary Clinton represents a continuation of what Obama believes. People have to remember that Hillary Clinton and the Clinton Foundation have taken hundreds of millions of dollars from the Saudis, from Qatar, from Kuwait, and various other Arab states. And that's why she says, oh, there's no such thing as Muslim terrorism, and you shouldn't say mean things about Muslims. I think personally she doesn't give a shit about Muslims, but she has been bought off, to say the least, and that is something that she owes allegiance to now. And you see on the other side, Trump, who doesn't care either way, saying the truth, that we have to start dealing with this problem, that this is a problem that is going to kill us if we don't deal with it. And that is something that he is early in saying, and this is something that I don't think is racist. I think that this is something that relates very much to what's happening in Europe, and Europe actually may be too far gone to even be saved at this point. But the United States is still very much at a tipping point, and this is something that people have to be aware of. Now, when I talk to people out in the audience, I'll tell you this. If you're over 18, I think it's important not just to have rights, but to exercise them. I urge every one of you to go and buy weapons, to buy guns, to have a gun, to learn how to use it safely, excuse me, to teach your children how to use it, and to be aware that this is something that can be taken away from you. When you look at the Nazi country, Germany.
Adam, may I jump in a second?
Sure.
We have callers. Do you want to talk to them today?
Absolutely.
I don't want to lose them.
One more word, then I'm going to get to the callers. When you look at what happened in Nazi Germany, what ended up happening, the first thing they did is they disarmed the population. They took the guns away from people. And so, final word, buy a gun, teach your children how to use them properly, and learn to protect yourself and to love your freedom. And I'm ready for the callers, Tom.
Well, now we have to take all the breaks we missed. So we're going to do that. And of course, if you want to talk to Adam, criminal defense attorney Adam Sachs, you call this number right now, 901-3000-TOM. That's our number. 901-3000-TOM. Let's go. 901-3000-866.
Tom Likas, the Internet's most listened to call-in show. 901-3000-TOM. This is the Tom Likas Show.
It's the Tom Likas Show. It's the bonus hour here. Criminal defense attorney Adam Sachs at 901-3000-TOM. That's our number. 901-3000-TOM. 901-3000-866. Jonathan Riverside, I know you've been holding on a long time. Say hi to Adam.
Hi there, Adam.
Hey, Jonathan.
Hello, Dad. Long-time listener, first-time caller. Adam,
thank you.
I have a question.
Sure.
I have a question regarding growing in a leased house, growing marijuana. I just want to know what the biggest concerns I should be thinking of when attempting to do that.
Okay. Well, the bottom line is there are actually some lawyers that specialize in marijuana. And certainly could help you reach one of those. I've done a lot of defense cases for people caught with marijuana. And the first thing that you have to recognize, which is absolutely crazy and rather schizophrenic of our government, in California, for example, is that marijuana is still illegal. And the laws against it are still on the books. And they're just not enforced. That's the difference. And the federal government has a whole separate range of laws which are enforced, and that's why you have the kind of conflict. And what's happened to a lot of marijuana stores is they're selling it theoretically under the protection of the law and these different propositions that were passed, but then meanwhile they get raided by the police because we're sort of existing in these two worlds at the same time. And what's unbelievable about growing marijuana, for example, as you say, in your own place, and this has been true of some like warehouses that have been growing marijuana indoors and stuff, is that they're actually, the police, this is, and the authorities are actually studying patterns of electricity use and water use. And you may not believe this, but if you have this house, let's say, and you're growing marijuana in the house or whatever, you may be using halogen lamps or whatever, and those lamps are actually going to be consuming a lot of electricity, probably more electricity than a normal house in your neighborhood. So in other words, if you look at the regular street that you're on, maybe you're using 5 or 10 times more electricity than your neighbors do. And that is going to come up statistically by computer modeling in a way that the company is going to report to the police. And also your water pattern use may be different because you're watering all these marijuana plants. I think this is a good argument, something that Tom has done himself, which is to have solar panels and get the hell off the grid, you know, because the power company are going to report you. Yeah.
What about if the power consumption is in line with, you know, what was expected out of the house?
Right. Well, there you go. Off the grid. So if you are able to keep things normal and use solar power, or you're growing the plants in your yard or whatever, so you're not particularly using more electricity, there's also the consideration of water, which is also monitored to some degree. But the reality is that the police are still actively raiding people that grow marijuana, and it is still illegal. And there are some principles that they've gotten into. There are certain things written into the laws, and this also varies a little bit from county to county based on their own enforcement. But they'll have this kind of thing that you can grow it, but you're only allowed to have 10 plants or 20 plants. And there are certain things that you can do commercially where you're allowed to have a larger number of plants, but again, limited and definitely very hysterical. So you're doing
like
something.
Like a cultivator's license with 99 plants. I've heard of those
exactly.
before. Actually, the question about that, though, is like, I know that there's like a federal statute over 100 plants in any like one location.
Right.
But, I mean, what if there are multiple cultivator like recommendations that are, you know, justify the numbers there? Is it still something that's going to
yeah.
be a conflict of interest?
Yeah, it's going to be a problem. I think one of the great lessons that I learned from Tom Likas recently in his endeavor of making wine, which is legal, right? Alcohol is legal under, you know, basic circumstances, is how regulated it is. And that you have to
right.
have licenses to sell in different states, and you're supposed to bottle it a certain way, and you have to have an FBI background check if you're a vintner or whatever. And, you know, Tom, as I understand, has an attorney who is a wine expert who helped him deal with this, and you are going to have a marijuana expert do the same exact thing, because there are
okay.
so many rules and so many regulations, and it is so easy for you to very unintentionally go afoul of some of the regulations without meaning to, and the consequences are very dire. I mean, all of a sudden you've committed a serious crime, the police raid your place, they take all your marijuana, they seize your money, your house, and you're screwed. So you want to do it properly in the same way that a winemaker needs to do it properly and follow the rules. This is a heavily regulated industry like so many other things in this country, and regulations stifle commerce. And one of the ways that you have to protect yourself in terms of obeying and following the laws is by having an attorney, not after you get arrested, but going beforehand to make sure that you comply as much as possible.
Right. Okay. Yeah. The thing is, too, as far as the local police versus, I know that, you know, the feds just ain't, you know, it's completely illegal under any, you know, any plan.
Yeah,
it
is.
Under federal law. But as far as, like, I know a lot of local police departments and everything, they're so relaxed on it. I mean, does that have any bearing into the, like, you know, how dangerous it is as far as, because I, for example, I know in, like, certain cities, like, the police, they raid places.
Yeah.
And, or, like, for example, like a place, they would find out about it, and then the police would come through, they would sweep through, and no actions were taken.
I understand.
So.
This is something I think, for example, I saw raids that were done in downtown Los Angeles that would never have been done in some of the more northern counties. There are some counties, I hate to say the names, but there are some counties in you know, mid and northern California that this is one of their largest industries, growing marijuana. And there are examples of marijuana being grown on state land and so forth. And I think that those counties that are more dependent on it in their local economies, more used to it locally, are much more inclined to not bother growers as long as they're generally following the rules and not raid them and so forth. And the police certainly have limited resources and have to choose what they want to spend their resources on. And it seems that in a county like Los Angeles or San Diego, the police are more inclined to raid marijuana growing facilities than, like I said, some of these more rural counties in other parts of the state. And so you should think very carefully where you're going to put yourself. And I got to tell you, I can't emphasize it enough, don't hire a lawyer after you get arrested. Hire a lawyer before you start, just to make sure
okay.
that you're doing it right and you're following the laws as much as you can. And there are actually attorneys that specialize in this, and it would be worthwhile to spend a few hours with one of them and to just talk about your project and to make sure that you're doing it correctly, because there are certain things that you can do that will avoid you having problems later. And I think that's probably a great idea.
Well, it makes a lot of sense. Thank you, Adam. I appreciate that.
Good. I hope it helps you. Good luck with that.
Thanks. Can you take me out with a long bong rip and Snoop Dogg style?
Here you go, Jonathan. Biatch. All right. We'll take a break here. More of your calls coming up. We'll say how you can get in touch with Adam at 901-3000. Tom, that's our number, 901-3000-866.
The entire Tom Likas experience in your pants.
Get the app now.
901-3000-TOM. This is the Tom Likas Show.
The Tom Likas Show. Kelly Haley, defense attorney Adam Sachs. Adam, how can people get in touch with you?
Well, you can call me toll-free at 1-800-340-7320. That's 1-800-340-7320. You can check me out on Facebook and also on the World Wide Web at www.adamlawyer.com and send me an email, which I love, and I will answer personally, adam@adamlawyer.com.
Now, before I let you go, we had a caller in a previous hour.
Okay.
Who was calling in to talk about the clergy and about... he claimed, this was an attorney, and he was in America, but he was calling from South Korea.
Okay.
And he said that I was pointing out that the Catholic Church had all of these cases with people saying they were abused by priests. And he called in to say, well, the church can't really turn those people in because if it's a confession, they've got certain privileges. And they, if a priest comes in to the cardinal and says, I screwed up and I had sex with a kid, the cardinal or whoever it is at the church can't turn him in because of this privilege. Is that true?
No, that's not true. There is privileges. There are various kinds. For example, between a husband and a wife, generally speaking, a spouse cannot be compelled to testify against the other spouse. And there's the attorney-client privilege. That is the strongest privilege of all, which means that if someone talks to me as their attorney, the things they tell me are confidential and I can't repeat what I heard or testify against them. That makes sense. And then there's the priest and penitent privilege, which is when someone in the context of like the Catholic Church, for example, goes into a confession booth and confesses, that is something that cannot be reused. One of the more famous cases of that was a guy named Hansen, who was a spy for the Soviet Union against the United States. He was an FBI agent, high-ranking, and he had confessed to his priest that he had betrayed the United States and given secrets to the Soviets against the U.S. interests. And this is something that the priest never told anyone about because it was in the context of a confession. Now, a priest who is a pedophile who tells his superior priest, the bishop or whoever it is, that he's done some terrible thing to a child, he is not confessing. He's not doing that in the context of a confession. He's talking to someone in the priesthood. My understanding from what I've read of the cases, particularly the cases in the United States, the priests that had sex with children, and that was extremely common, were generally notorious. And it wasn't something they confessed to higher level priests in the organization. These were priests that were known to be pedophiles. And this was known among the rank and file, the other priests, and they had gone and been involved in this sort of thing for very long periods of time. And the tendency of the Catholic Church was to transfer them and to send them somewhere else. Now, if they were trying to protect them in some way or they didn't want them to be prosecuted, the thing they should have really done is retired them. They should have said, okay, you touched a kid, that's unacceptable, and you're not a priest anymore, and, you know, go do something else with your life, rather than report it to the police is probably what they should have done. But the idea that they kept them and transferred them from parish to parish, where they then molested more kids in other places, and that this is protected by some kind of confidence between priests and their penitents is nonsense. There's no connection to that at all. Now, these people are notoriously known by the various rank-and-file members. They should have been reported. And if the guy actually confessed and he actually said to his superior, whoever that is, a bishop or an archbishop or whatever, like that guy Bernard Law in Boston, who was very aware of the pedophile priests, and they had spoken to him directly, and he also had heard about them and so forth, for him to claim that that was protected by some kind of privilege or confessional privilege is what we call bullshit.
That's what I thought, but I thought I'd check with you, and he asked me to ask you, so I did.
Fair enough.
So there we go. All right, one more time, how can people get in touch with you?
You can call me toll-free at 1-800-340-7320, 1-800-340-7320. You can send me an email, adam@adamlawyer.com.
All right. Don't forget, there's a bonus hour on the Tom Likas Show, and Adam will be back here coming up on Tuesday at 6 p.m. Pacific Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Time.
Don't let your smartphone be a dumbass. Download the Tom Likas app now.
901-3000-TOM. This is the Tom Likas Show.
from the New Normal Newsroom, it's news for guys. I'm Gary Zeno.
Better believe it.
Amber Heard has retracted her spousal support request.
I'm thinking this is a PR move.
Is Glorious involved still? What happened with that?
I don't know. I know he is represented by the best.
Right.
In my opinion.
And
the
she
best.
Apparently, and we've seen pictures of it, met at some point with Gloria Allred's office.
I don't see her retaining, let's see. She actually met with Samantha Spector. That's somebody different than Gloria's.
All right. Well, I mean, look, she asked for the money and it was denied last week. Maybe, you know, going forward, they rethunk this situation.
Correct, because now it's kind of damage control. Things have to be painted a certain way.
Right.
And, you know, the court of public opinion is important here, too.
Mm-hmm. I suppose so.
I don't...
Yeah. What?
I just... I as much as it pains me, I'm rooting for Johnny Depp here.
Right. You have to. Of course.
And, I mean, you're talking about a guy with eye makeup a fake accent.
We'll take the headshot and the BB gun and we'll just do the same thing over again. Prosecutors have dropped the domestic violence case against WWE superstar Adam Rose.
Yeah, I read about this from Knights of the Turnbuckle
this morning.
Of course
you did.
And it turns out that prosecutors have dropped the domestic violence case against our friend Adam.
This is one of them deals, dude. You know, the cops show up. She says he grabbed her face, ripped the phone away from her when she went to call 911. And then when the cops take him down and it's time to go to court, she says, oh, nothing really happened.
Right. The attorney representing Mr. Rose said that this the charges were dropped in this case as both he and his wife have maintained from the beginning that Mr. Rose was absolutely innocent.
Is that just it? It's just Adam Rose? It's not like the fabulous Adam Rose or something
you know,
like that?
I'm not quite sure. I think he's a disgraced or a fallen WWE guy. I'm almost sure.
Yeah, well, because they have a zero-tolerance policy for domestic violence, and so he had to then go to them and request... I guess they tossed him or suspended him. Then he requested a release from the organization.
Right. Well, the one part of the whole thing is he was, and again, this is a Knights of the Turnbuckle thing, he wrestled under the Florida Heavyweight Champion belt under the name Leo Kruger, so he did have different names.
All right.
But that was way back in the day.
Deadpool alert here. Look out, because the U.S. apparently awaiting confirmation that perhaps the leader of ISIS, al-Baghdadi, could be dead.
Right. The only downside to these stories is this is about the 11th time he was killed, but usually where there is smoke... there's fire, and in this case, we've been pounding Raqqa and a few other cities trying to out this guy, and it looks like there's several reports saying that he's dead. Again, this has happened literally 11 other times.
Right.
But for some reason, this one seems to have more traction than others.
Well, I mean, as of today, right out of Obama's mouth, we had done turned it up.
Right,
yes.
And we're basically whacking cities and waiting for these guys to scramble,
right.
And we're pounding their positions and trying to weed them out.
Exactly. Plenty more news for guys.com, and of course you can find our podcast at GaryAndDino.com from the New Normal Studios in Burbank. We're back to the Tom Likas Show right after this.
This is the New Normal.
And that's insane.